Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the GeoMob Podcast for another episode that involves Earth observation. We have a very interesting topic to discuss today, SEPA's Satellite Emergency Mapping Service. With me to talk about this is Claire Neal, Principal EOS Scientist at SEPA. How are you doing, Claire?
I'm good, thank you, Alistair. Yeah, very happy to be here.
Excellent. It's great to have you here. Could you introduce the listeners to SEPA and maybe some of the work that they do, and also let us know a little bit about your journey in geospatial?
Yeah, of course. So I work at SEPA, which is the Scottish Environment Protection Agency. SEPA are Scotland's principal environmental regulator, so it's our role to protect and improve Scotland's environment. There's lots of ways that we do this, lots of remits that fit within that role. So those include monitoring and reporting on the current state of the environment, compliance checking and regulation, and then finally warning the public in the event of an environmental incident. So that could be flooding or another type of pollution incident. So my own journey in Earth observation is quite long. I've been in this field for a long time. So it probably starts back around 2003, where I was an undergraduate student studying physics at the University of Strathclyde. My final year dissertation was looking at using satellite imagery, and really that's where my love of the topic grew. I followed there into a PhD in ocean optics, which was really looking at developing algorithms to convert light that is observed by satellites into geophysical properties such as water quality parameters. After completing my PhD, I moved to the south of France and started a research fellowship with the French Space Agency.
Very nice.
Yeah, it's a lot of money, I did tell you. And I was based in Nice as well, which is just such a beautiful part of the world. I came back to Scotland in 2013, and that was the first job that I had at SEPA. So I was a data scientist then. I had all of this knowledge and information about satellites, but when I started, I was really shocked to discover that they weren't really using satellites or Earth observation at all. So of course, this is 2013. It was before the Sentinel program, so it was a bit early. But in 2015, I took a bit of a risk. I left SEPA, went to start working at the University of Stirling to really start developing the application and the awareness of the approach itself. So there I had a knowledge exchange fellowship that was funded by NERC, and I was really able to start a network of different stakeholders, different users. So that included environmental regulators such as SEPA and the EA, which is the English counterpart. But also water companies as well. So we worked together, built that awareness, and then in 2020, I have the job at SEPA that I have now, which is really about developing our Earth observation capabilities from the inside.
Yeah, cool. That's an interesting date, actually, 2020 is starting up. So with the whole lockdown and everything else, it's a really good time, I guess, for a SEPA to start looking at remote options for monitoring and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So I started May 2020, so it was really strange starting a new job. You're just in lockdown. Thankfully, I knew a lot of people from my previous experience at SEPA, but it was a really daunting time to be starting a new job. At the end of that year as well, December 2020, SEPA had a cyber attack. It was really a pivotal moment. We lost a lot of our information. We lost a lot of our systems. So it was really a moment where we could take a step back and reflect and say, can we do this better? Is there things that we could actually be looking at that can improve our operations? So you had the lockdown, and then you had the cyber attack, which was a bad thing for a lot of people. But for me, it actually opened up a lot of opportunities.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant to look at that as an opportunity, basically, and as a way of sort of resetting and thinking about, okay, how can we do things from scratch almost, and really put in place all the systems and everything else that are needed. Well, that's really interesting. So SEMS, I'm going to call it SEMS because that's much easier. SEMS. Where did the idea for this come about? And in fact, actually, maybe we should start with what is it? And that would be a good place to really inform our listeners about the system we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about.
Of course. So this is the SEPA's new Satellite Emergency Mapping Service. It was a service that was launched in September last year, so it's new. We're still new. But that came through around 2 years of development. So it didn't happen overnight. There was a lot of work and effort behind the scenes that went into creating it. So essentially, it's a service that is providing access to satellite-derived information and products during disasters in Scotland. So primarily, it's probably going to be focusing on those sort of flood-type disasters, maybe some snow and ice events as well, but it does cover other types of disasters, such as fire, landslides, really any kind of disaster that has that immediate sort of response. So not the slow burner ones like drought, for example, but something that happens immediately and then obviously benefits from having that bird's eye perspective to help with the response to the disaster. So it's new, as I say, but we're not reinventing the wheel. Essentially, what we've done is bring together two separate programmes. So those are the Copernicus Emergency Management Service and also the International Charter for Space and Major Disasters. Those are two programmes that have been running globally for decades. Actually, in the case of the Charter, it's been running for decades, but it's completely underused in the UK and Scotland. So really the whole point of the Satellite Emergency Mapping Service is bringing this information together and making the information that's generated available to the emergency responders, so the police, the fire, on the ground when they actually need them. So that's what we've done.
Oh, cool. Okay, so it sounds to me like there's a few things that can be unpacked there. So it's very interesting that you're talking about different types of sort of immediate emergencies. We had a couple of big storms at the end of last year, and we've had some icy weather at the beginning of this year. Is this something, like, are you in a testing phase at the moment, or is it out and operational at the moment? And are those events big enough that they've been requiring SEMS?
Yeah. So it is operational. So we have activated it. We're right in the midst of an activation right now, actually. We activated it on the 30th of December for the floods in the sort of north central around the Spey area in Scotland. So we had significant floods that came off the back of the rain, the bad weather that we had. So yeah, we're right in the middle of an activation now. It's been quite an fortunate situation because we had developed it. This was the first time that we activated it, but actually it was de-escalated, or it was downgraded from a severe weather event, which meant that even though we had activated it and we were collecting the satellite information, we didn't have to share it with the emergency responders on the ground, which means we've got this situation where we can test the service and the process without having that immediate demand for the information on the ground. So yes, absolutely, it's been used, and we've had a chance to iron out any issues, which has been really good. In terms of the sort of thresholds for activation, it's quite loose. So danger to life or significant economic damage. That's the sort of criteria that we need in order to activate it. When it's activated, it would come through a multi-agency response. So we wouldn't activate it in a situation where there's maybe only, you know, one police agency or who's interested. It has to come through that multi-agency response so that we have the understanding that the incident itself is severe enough to warrant the additional information.
Okay. Oh, cool. So one of the other points that you made previously was that the Charter is underused in the UK, or has been in the past. Do you think that's because organisations and people in the UK don't know about it, or is it doesn't really fit for the UK use case, whereas what you've now developed fits better? How do you sort of what's been your experience really with the Charter?
Yeah, I think it's probably a mixture of all of that. So there's a need to raise awareness. There's also a need to create a prepared service. So this was the reason, the primary reason that we created the Satellite Emergency Mapping Service, was that we had activated twice in the past. Even though we knew the information was coming, we really weren't ready for it. It's not a simple thing to just produce satellite images from lots of different satellites. There's 270 satellites included in the service. During an activation, you get, depending on what it is, but if it's a sort of 2 or 3 day event, you have hundreds of images that have to be processed. So it's not something that you can just do and use overnight. So even though we knew the information was coming, we weren't ready to process the data and make it readily available. And then, of course, the people on the ground, so the police, the fire brigade, they don't even know that it exists. So for us, we went through a long process of, it was described as roadshows, whereby we were meeting with the different stakeholders, with the emergency responders, the Category 1 and Category 2 emergency responders, to make them aware that it exists, that we are providing this service, so that they can then start implementing the use of that information at their side as well, so that you're not just popping up with a satellite image saying, here you go.
Yeah, I think quite often people forget just how large Scotland is and also how dispersed the population is. And you know, if you've got an emergency response organization, they have to be prepared to protect the life and the property of everybody in their area, and yet their area could be massive and very sparse in terms of the density of people. So it sounds really interesting in terms of what you're working with here. Are you able to talk about the data sets and the data sources that you put in, or any other methods, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I've mentioned, the service itself includes the satellites that are included in the International Charter and the Copernicus Emergency Management Service. It's around 270 satellites. Those fit into the, I know it's incredible.
That's amazing.
The different categories. You've got your optical satellites, which are used for things that, you know, you can visibly see. Mostly it's to do with the pollution events, to do with fire burn, those types of things. There's also the synthetic aperture radar satellites, which are used for mostly things that you could probably feel. So yes, it's really good for understanding the difference between wet and dry, for example. So you can use those for flood events and for snow and those types of things. 270 different satellites, it's a challenge being able to even understand how to process them. Some of them are really obscure, so you're receiving information from commercial satellites that possibly have never been processed in Scotland before. So there's that challenge. There's the challenge with that comes with the volume of data, because these satellites have spatial resolutions from around 23 centimetres. So that's, it's incredible. Yeah. It still blows my mind when I see them. I'm still, you know, in awe of what you can actually detect. So 23 centimetres, it means that you've got huge volumes of data to process. So your systems have to be developed and built in order to process those large volumes of data. And then there's the actual temporal frequency. So there's a lot. So 270 satellites means that you have images coming in every roughly about half an hour. So you've got all of these challenges that are associated with simply the type of data that you're using. So we've built our systems and our processes in order to cope and to deal with those types of data.
Wow. Okay. And I guess as well, like sometimes maybe if it's a pollution event that you need to respond to, you'll have a relatively small area, and I would hope that the back end systems sort of see that and you can be very, very focused in terms of small amounts of data. But I guess other times you might be the whole of the west of Scotland or the whole of Scotland, so that's a heck of a change in scale. Is it all set up to sort of to scale if needed? Is that's the way it's sort of set up for processing?
Yep, absolutely. That's the way that it is. So Okay. Even from the activation point all the way through to the data delivery and visualization, it's developed to optimize what you're trying to capture. So a pollution event, for example, the first thing that you specify your area of interest, and then you try and understand if there would be a characteristic that the satellite can actually show you. So you don't know.
Right.
It could be something that's visible. It could be something that's not visible. It could be something, you know, a temperature change. You don't really know. So you've got this screening process where you just really identify if it is something that can be picked up from the satellite, and then you build from there. You know, is it something that's increasing geographically? You know, is it extending that way? Is it something that might take weeks to capture, like oil spills, for example? It's more to do with the temporal period, the time frequency, rather than the area of interest. So yeah, it's all built to try and optimize the data capture so that we can deliver the information in a timely way.
Wow. The more you tell me about this, and the more I think about the actual individual steps that are required, like on the back end that people won't see, the more impressed I am by just how much effort there's going to have to be around automating, getting the right data in, understanding what processing methods need to happen with each of the different data sets. So if I was a first responder, what do I see? Like what does the user see?
So you see a map. It's really a simple map. It's a web map that we share.
Okay.
So we intentionally keep it as simple as possible because we don't want to add an extra level of complexity in a situation that's already very intense.
Yes.
So it's a simple map. For floods, for example, it just shows you the vector shape files, which is the flood extent. You can zoom in, you can zoom out, you can search for specific locations, and there's a slider which allows you to go back to previous images and see how things are developing, escalating as well. So we've kept it as simple as possible, but we are also working with the emergency responders to build in functionality that they need. So if there's a particular tool that they think would be useful, because we've developed and built the map ourselves in SEPA, then we've got the control over adding those extra bells and whistles that will help people use it.
Wow. Okay. So just to flip it back again to the sort of the data and the methods. So I remember thinking it was about 2 years ago, there was a really, really big storm hit Britain. And I've got some family up in Aberdeenshire, and they were saying how basically, everybody hunkered down for the storm. And then when they woke up the next day, there were just trees everywhere. And it absolutely wiped out large areas of forestry. And I've seen some pictures that they sent me. And yeah, we're not messing around here. Loads of trees came down. Is that the sort of thing also that this service would be looking at, sort of trying to understand where trees have fallen across roads, that sort of thing? Because I guess that's immediate, but maybe not danger to life. It's more of a just trying to reconnect communities type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the other side of it that we've not discussed. It's been developed for emergency responders, but really the information and the products can be used by any stakeholder after the event as well. So I am working with Scottish Forestry to try and build in their needs into the service.
Okay.
So that you have not just the emergency respond, but also the impact assessment to be able to understand what the impact is after the event as well. So that's all built into the service. The products, essentially, when they are processed and when the products are created, are open source, so we can share them with anybody that needs them.
Okay.
So we're working with Scottish Forestry, with Flood Re, with British Geological Survey, with a number of different organisations to try and help them use this information in the best way that they can, so that we can essentially strengthen the service from it as well. So absolutely, it's about all of that sort of during and also impact after.
And what are the plans for making sure that sort of methods remain updated? Because I guess, as with all things Earth observation and geospatial data sciency, every year there will be new methods of processing data or new data sources, I'm sure, which you'll be trying to suck into the service as well. So how do you stay on top of all of that? And do you have plans for it to continually incrementally sort of improve, inverted commas, in terms of the methods? Because obviously, yeah, these things, these things change. I guess improve is not always the best word, but sort of.
Well, I think it is. I think that's a good word. You know, we've just started this. We've only used the activations three times. We've activated four SEMs once, so absolutely we'll continue to improve. The way that we stay on top of it is by sticking or working with those partners. So we're not isolated, we're not independent. We rely heavily on our academic partners, for example, or the experts in the scenarios themselves. So okay. We work closely with Stirling University, who are the experts that have brought forward the processing pipeline for floods. And then it's described as value adders. So any other value adders that can add to the service by providing their own templates for their own products, then absolutely we would want to be working with them to bring that into the service as well. So it's fluid, it's agile, it will grow and it will develop as people are using it. One of the concerns for SEPA, not concerns, but one of the things just to look out for is that it's not overused, because of course a service like this, you can imagine it would be activated a lot. It could be used so many ways. Yeah. It can be activated lots of times, so we have to make sure that we are keeping the service viable by only activating it during the events that need it, but absolutely bringing in the value adders where we can.
And are you finding that there's interest from similar bodies like the Environment Agency south of the border?
Yeah, so we started that conversation. So the UK Space Agency, for example, were there when we launched the service. So they were really excited and enthusiastic to see this type of service being created. It's easier in Scotland because of the way that we work. So we've got, you know, one police board, we've got one water board, we've got the SEPA. In England, it's a bit more siloed. So yeah. You can imagine it would be much more difficult to create a similar service in England. But certainly DEFRA and the UK Space Agency, they're all aware that we're doing this, or we have done it. And the hope would be that it would be extended south of the border eventually.
That's really cool. It's brilliant to see a system, like a government system, that's been created and is up and running and is being used. And part of me says I want to see it used more, but then obviously the situations in which it's being used, you really don't want to see it being used more. So is the entire thing funded via Scottish Government? Is that how it stays up and running, or are there plans to sort of try and make it commercially viable, or is it because it's an emergency system, it once it's up and running, it's sort of ring-fenced, I guess, in terms of money?
Yeah, so we won't be making it a commercial service. It will stay as it is, I think, because absolutely it's an emergency service. You don't want to try and profit in the situations where people are potentially suffering. Sure. So yeah, so it's paid for by SEPA. So SEPA have taken the costs on board for roughly 10 activations per year. I can't envisage that we would have more than 10 activations per year. But yes, it is a service that's paid for by SEPA and will continue to be free to the public sector in Scotland.
That's excellent. That's very, very cool. So one of the other things I wanted to just delve into a little bit is, and maybe everybody is really busy working on this because it sounds an amazing service, but could you let us know a little bit more about the other types of work that the SEPA Earth Observation team do, and the sorts of topics that you're interested in, the types of processing you do, that sort of thing?
Of course, yeah. So as I've mentioned, my role at SEPA is to develop our Earth Observation capabilities. So SEMS is one project, you would say, or program that falls within that. But really, there's a lot. There's a lot of work that we're doing in that area across SEPA. I describe it as a sort of revolution at the moment, whereby we have taken that step back and we're looking at situations where we could complement or improve our services by using not just satellite data, but other Earth observation data, sensors, IoT networks, drones, handheld device data capture. So we're looking at lots of areas where we can improve our processes by incorporating that information. So some that I can use just as an example is around soil moisture. So looking at the ground and understanding the water content within the soil, that's been used to understand really two extremes. So you've got water scarcity that is sort of not driven by, but is a fact, what where the moisture content is a factor for water scarcity. In drought situations where, of course, it's a drought, things are becoming drier, so we really want to understand the areas, the dryness, and how we can use the information from satellites to improve our knowledge of where these things are happening beyond the models that we use. But also, on the flip side, gives you the areas where you're likely at risk of flooding, because if the soil is either too dry or it's too saturated, then that's really the areas where you're at risk of flash floods as well. So soil moisture is one of the sort of key priorities that we're working on developing an operational system to monitor that. And that's coming from two different sources. So we're using Planet data. And, yep, so I know that you had a Planet representative yet in the last show. So you'll know all about Planet. We're looking at Planet data and also the Copernicus data. The Copernicus off-the-shelf model from the Copernicus Land Monitoring Service. So that's one of the areas, but there's other areas such as using the satellite data to give us concentrations of water quality parameters. So, for example, chlorophyll, which is a proxy for phytoplankton, we're using satellites to monitor the concentrations of chlorophyll in lakes and also around coastal areas. So, again, it's all about having that bird's eye perspective that really gives you information that there's no other way of collecting it. You know, historically, we send somebody out to take a sample. It could be one sample for one huge water body, whereas you can use satellites to give you huge areas that are showing real variability within a single water body, and it's really the only approach that can do that. So those are the water quality parameters that we're looking at, but we're also looking at operationalizing the flood extent. So beyond just using it in emergencies, we want to have a system that's capturing it all the time. So every time a new Sentinel-1 image is downloaded, we can determine if there's any flood detected in that image on a, you know, a, not a daily, but a near daily or a weekly basis. So it's about operationalizing the information that's available freely. I could talk for this for another hour. There's so many things that we're doing. Temperature is another one. So we're looking at temperature in rivers and around coastal areas to really try and understand if temperature or how temperature is feeding into those risk areas as well. So, for example, if you've got a drought situation, you know that the temperature of the water is probably going to change, and we're looking at whether or not we can use that to try and identify areas at risk of droughts as well. So there's lots of ways that we're using satellites to try and complement our standard practices.
And what satellite are you using for the temperature data, Nate? Because that's quite specialised.
yeah, absolutely. So it depends on the situation. So Landsat for the coastal areas, we're looking at using Landsat to give us the bathing water temperature. So SEPA is responsible for ensuring that bathing waters are safe and clean. So we can also add temperature to our bathing water signs. But we're also working with a commercial satellite company called SatView, who have the higher spatial resolution temperature data that we can start using that to look at rivers, for example, cool. to see how the temperature is changing in rivers.
Oh, wow, really nice. And are you also sort of interested in the whole rewilding thing? That I know there's lots of rewilding happening in England and Wales. I'm guessing in Scotland there's huge swathes of it happening as well. Is that something that SEPA monitors, or are people sort of allowed to just crack on and get on with it?
So it's not quite under SEPA's remit. That sits more with NatureScot. Yeah. But absolutely, we work with NatureScot on a number of different programs as well. So we really try to align our knowledge, our expertise, and our outputs to ensure that we're working together for that maximum effect.
Okay, that's cool. That brings me to my last question, which is going to be that, so you mentioned right at the beginning that in 2013, there was effectively you who knew about Earth observation and was pushing remote sensing. are you finding now that not just in SEPA, but sort of across government agencies, there's a lot more people who understand the technology, but there's also a lot of people who may not understand the technical side of it, but are asking for Earth observation related data sets and monitoring and all of that stuff? It sounds like there is, but I was just wondering if you've seen that definite difference in the sort of 10, 12 years since you first went back to SEPA.
Yeah, absolutely. So that mini revolution that I described at SEPA is not just SEPA. That's happening across the public sector. So right. Yeah, I've seen lots of different organisations who are now much more aware of what's available and aware of the potential and the benefits that this additional information can bring. So yeah, absolutely. We work closely with different sectors, with the aquaculture sector, for example, with the whisky sectors. And just even through those conversations, the awareness and knowledge about satellite data and Earth observation data more generally and what it can add to their businesses is huge. So yeah. So yes, we're definitely seeing that across different sectors in Scotland now.
That's brilliant. I love it when there's positive stories about Earth observation. It's really, really heartening.
Absolutely. It feels, as I say, I've been doing this for nearly 18 years now, and it feels that we've reached that tipping point where we're it's tipped. There's no, you know, there's no going back now. It's there, and the public are aware of it. The you know, the different sectors, private, public, people are aware of it now, so there's no going back. So the development can only go in one way, which is really positive when you've been banging that drum for a long time.
Brilliant. Claire, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. It's been really informative and really, really interesting. How can people get in touch with you if they want to or need to?
So they can get in touch with myself. I'm not sure if you share contact details, Alistair, after the podcast, or
If you've got a link or something, we can put it into the episode notes.
Okay, I'll do that. So you can get in touch with myself. There's always a way to get in touch with SEPA as well through the general contact information. And if it is satellite related, it will find its way to me eventually. But absolutely. So you know, just a sort of a mention to any other value adders who could potentially see a benefit and have an access to this information, then absolutely get in touch with me. Anybody that's interested in satellites more generally and how that fits with environmental monitoring, then also I'd be equally happy to speak to them.
That's brilliant. Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.